Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
This week on the PR Moment podcast, we've got Joe Carr, co-founder and chief client officer at Hope & Glory. For those of you that don't know, Hope & Glory was co-founded by Joe and James Gordon McIntosh in 2011. It now has a fee income of about £8.5 million, employs about 80 people, and grew by 25% in 2019. Before we start, the normal self-interest plugs from me. We've put together what I reckon is the best programme I've ever seen for a comms event discussing purpose. You'll get to hear from in-house comms experts about how they are embedding purpose at the heart of their businesses, how they've got boards to give them a purpose budget, and why purpose does get ROI for their businesses. All the details on the homepage of PRMoment.com. Also, slightly depending on when you're listening to this, the PR Moment Awards are coming up in London on March 26th. There are a few tickets remaining, but all indications are that we're going to sell out. So if you do want a ticket and you haven't got one yet, you need to get a wriggle on. Finally, thanks so much, as ever, to our PR Moment podcast sponsors, the PRCA. Joe, I've been dying to get you on the show for a while. Welcome to the PR Moment podcast.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's good to be here.
Now, in true PR style, originally you wanted to be a journo, didn't you? Is that right? Or work in advertising?
I did. I think partly because I love writing.
Okay.
And also I love the kind of idea of being creative and planning and actually dealing with clients, which I guess is the advertising bit.
Right.
And then I stumbled along across PR and it seemed to be a wonderful hybrid of all of that.
So the cynic in me says you didn't become a journo because you wanted to earn more money. And you didn't become, well, not really a cynic, but why didn't you go into, is that right? Or, is, you know, why did you end up in PR as opposed to journalism or indeed advertising?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think journalism, certainly when people start out, isn't very well paid. And it's a long old training journey. You know, you do your stint on a local paper, you do your stint on a regional paper. I didn't think I quite had the stamina for that. And I think advertising, I wanted to do a bit of everything and I worried that I would probably just be a suit in the client department. And actually, I quite like being creative and looking at the strategy. So it was a kind of a good hybrid.
So I can't quite remember. Did you find PR or did PR find you?
I kind of found PR,
okay.
But I didn't find it straight away. I was at university, thought it sounded like a good career path, in the way that when you're 21, you're trying to pluck a career path out of the ether. But actually, I went to Japan for 2 years before stumbling into PR in Hong Kong.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, because, I mean, just to fill listeners in, post-uni you went to Japan for a couple of years to teach English. Then you came back, you worked at the communications group QBO, which became QBO Bell Pottinger, and then latterly Team Spirit. So I was just trying to work it out in my head. You were pretty much a sort of corporate, corpsumer PR person. Corpsumer is a horrible word, isn't it? I wish I hadn't said it now. But you had a sort of twist of financial services, and then now you're this, I don't want to call you a consumer PR guru, guru is an equally awful word, but you know, it's interesting that you made that switch, as far as I can see, relatively late in your career.
That's right. I did probably start at the more corporate end of the spectrum. I'm never truly a corporate.
Is that because you didn't want to be and you just ended up...
Yeah, I didn't want to be.
Okay.
But I particularly liked consumer finance. Okay. And had a number of consumer finance clients. But you're right, as I've got older, I've actually ended up on more out-and-out consumer brand work, which is fun. You know, it's where I wanted to be.
So you sort of ended up doing corporate because you ended up doing corporate. It wasn't necessarily... you didn't have a change of tack in terms of what you wanted to do halfway through your career. It was just that circumstances meant that you ended up doing corporate work as opposed to consumer work.
Yeah, I think when I started out, the brands that I started working with, they were doing what I would call kind of soft corporate, and probably weren't as brave as the brands that I'm working with now. So while in their mind they thought they were doing consumer PR, they weren't really.
It's all a spectrum, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think now brands are... I mean, I think we have a much more clearly defined idea of what consumer PR is, and it's likely to be experiential, it's likely to be some social, there's likely to be content. And I think when I started out, actually brands haven't got to that really.
Well, I think, is that right? Is that just a Hope & Glory or agencies like you? Because I always think that you're the sort of consumer shops, so to put it that way, have a different definition of consumer PR than, I don't know, the larger firms. They're not quite. It's not quite the same type of work, is it?
I think we would probably talk about ourselves as being a creative shop.
Okay.
And I think we put a lot of emphasis on the idea and then how that idea is delivered. And it could be through a whole raft of different things, whether that's experiential, whether that's media relations, whether that's through an event. So perhaps I would say we've pushed the boundaries a bit more
okay.
Than perhaps some agencies.
But it's interesting, you made that shift, as I say, to consumer PR quite late. Was that a difficult thing to do, just in terms of, frankly, getting the job? Was it hard to turn up at, we'll talk about it in a minute, but it was basically 77 PR, wasn't it? Say, I've been a corporate PR person, now I want to be a consumer PR person. Oh, and by the way, I want to be whatever you were at the time, an MD or on the board or an alt. So it's not an easy one to pull off in the interview, is it?
Do you know, I think I was never kind of corporate with a capital C.
No.
So I think I was always, I'd always done a bit of both.
Okay.
It wasn't such a big...
So I'm over-egging it.
You are slightly over-egging the pudding, but that's fine. That's fine. I think I was closer to being a consumer PR. But I wasn't probably your classic consumer PR.
Okay.
So you're right in that respect. You know, I hadn't been brought up in a Freud's or I guess an environment where that was purely all I had done.
Okay, fine. Now, when you came back from Japan, you briefly joined the communications group in something like 1995. So we're way back here.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. Long time ago.
I didn't mean it like that. The reason why I mentioned that will come clear now. But I don't want to dwell on it. But because all the personalities involved have long since moved on. But it's clearly a move that didn't quite work out. And we've all had them. I've certainly had them in my career. But what I quite like about your story on that is that you didn't hang around, frankly. It didn't work out and you moved on. Just talk us through how you did that at the time, how you did that and how you felt at the time. Because I think it's a situation that lots of people find themselves in their career, and it's probably quite important to be brave at that moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a firm believer that everybody has and is allowed to have a blip on their CV. And I think if I look back, that was definitely my blip. I'd come back from Hong Kong, where I'd had 3 years in the industry. I probably thought I knew it all, which, of course, I didn't. I took an account manager position, and it just, you know, for all sorts of reasons, wasn't the right environment for me. And I think I just realised that life is too short. And actually, even now, sometimes, you know, people might say to me, oh, I think I need to move on. I've done, you know, 2 or 3 years here. And I say, look, just be very careful, because it's sort of same crap, excuse my language, but different bucket.
Right.
And if you're not careful, you know, you can move somewhere else. And if the environment isn't right, then I would really encourage you not to stay for too long. I mean, I'm a big believer that you should be the same person at work as you are at home.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're a slightly better version of yourself. You know, don't necessarily come to work in your pyjamas. But I do think you shouldn't have to feel like you're somebody else. I mean, and for whatever reason, for that job, I was playing somebody else. And it's not comfortable.
But it's easy to... I always think it's easier to work out looking back in hindsight than knowing it at the time, isn't it? At the time, it's quite a... You know, you might have a mortgage to pay or rent to pay, I don't know. But it's quite difficult. The pressures can build at that moment in your life, isn't it? So it's quite a brave thing to go, do you know what? No, I'm done, I'm out. I see lots of people in that same situation, and it's not easy to get out, but you do need to, I guess.
Well, I think there's that perceived wisdom of, oh, you have to do a year, you know, you have to do a year on your CV, and you really don't.
No.
And I think, actually, having interviewed lots of people over the years, I'm very understanding if somebody says, look, I went here, it wasn't right, and actually I got it after 3 months. I'm more likely to think, good on you.
Yeah.
Actually, you know yourself well enough to know that's not the place where you're going to thrive.
Yeah. Well, you can get dogged down if you're not careful, can't you, in a year or a year or two or whatever. Now, then, so after you came back, you joined QBO, and that, I suppose, was frankly your sort of... Was that sort of where you founded your career, was it?
I thought you were going to say that's where I found myself.
Well, I don't know about that, but maybe it was. But that was a chunky job for you, wasn't it? Where you probably, inverted commas, grew up as a professional
Definitely. I went in there, I was probably about, I think, 26 years old, 27 years old. Had a few years under my belt. And it was, for me, it was a great environment.
Right.
It was creative. It was very culturally, very kind of supportive. I got to work with some great clients, but I got to work with some great people.
Go on, who are the people? There were some legends there, weren't there?
There were. My boss at the time was a guy called Trevor Morris,
yeah.
Probably the man with the deepest voice in NPR.
We've all got a bit of envy at Trevor's voice, haven't we?
I mean, I think clients would, I think it was a secret weapon in a pitch meeting.
He should have been. He's got the lovely voice for radio. Why is he not doing a podcast? I don't know.
Brendan, you should get him on.
Yeah, definitely. But while you were there, QBO was sold to Bell Potts, right? Go on, talk me, because it was a bit more complicated. It was sold to Chime and then merged into Bell Pottinger.
I'd been there a few years, and I think the agency, I think QBO had been going for about 20.
Right.
And the time had come where the directors at the time decided it was time to kind of sell up, I guess. They sold to Chime. I think they did a pretty good deal. And then... We were probably quite independent still, even after the sale. It didn't feel like things had changed straight away.
Right.
But within a couple of years, we were then merged with Bell Pottinger Consumer, which was the consumer bit of Bell Pottinger at that time, which involved a move. So we were moved into the same offices over in Holborn.
And who was that? Was that Dave Wilson and all those sorts of people?
Exactly, And that was an interesting experience.
Right.
Because there were two quite different cultures being brought together.
And I don't know this, but I just wonder whether... Because the query we come on to in a minute, but everyone always says, oh, is Hope and Glory going to have that liquidity moment as well? And you and Jones, clearly, I am the last person you're going to tell if you are looking into that. But you've always both said very... Definitely no. And I just wonder whether your experiences during that merger have an influence on how you feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, right now, with Hope and Glory, absolutely no plans to have whatever the phrase is, a capital moment or whatever. Liquidity moment. Thank you, Ben. Mainly because we're having too much fun and right. We're enjoying it and we work with some brilliant people and we're enjoying the growth of that. Just thinking back to whether or not I've been put off it by that experience, possibly. I think on two levels. One is I think being part of a big group, going from an independent to being part of a larger group, I think is quite a hard gig. And actually, in some ways, it kind of suits my personality because I'm quite dealing with different people and
you're very organised.
I'm quite organised. I can certainly play the game, but it slows everything down.
Right.
And I think when now having run an independent agency, you realise that pace is your hallmark, and you can do things so much quicker than actually if you're part of a big group. And I saw that when QBO became QBO by Pottinger, decisions took longer. You couldn't just hire when you wanted to hire.
Yep.
You couldn't make promotions or do pay rises when you wanted to because you were part of a bigger infrastructure.
Yeah.
So there's that element. And then I think doing a merger is quite challenging because you've got, QBO was quite, there's probably a team of 50 when we merged. Had a bit of a family feel to it. Whereas I would have said Bell Pottinger at the time was a little bit more corporate.
Well, definitely.
Yeah, I think I realised how important culture is to an organisation and keeping that alive.
Yeah, I mean, it's not fair to say that no PR agency mergers or acquisitions have worked, but it's a pretty patchy history, isn't it? I think 50% is being a bit generous. There's lots that haven't worked out over the years. But having said that, if you're as a founder and an owner, We all grow older, don't we? And at some point, we've got to have a plan. So it's a difficult one to know when you're going to... how to get that right, I guess.
But, yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. Fine. Now we come sort of up to date with it all, really, to an extent. It was on leaving Chime, I think you'd latterly set up an early incarnation anyway of Team Spirit, where you moved to 77PR.
That's right.
Which, you know, it's a quite a way now in your career when you finally met up with James Gordon McIntosh.
Finally, yeah.
And that is, I'm assuming you're happy that you did, but you can tell us if you didn't in a minute. But that was clearly, for both of you, an absolutely career-defining bit of luck, frankly, wasn't it? That you, because you didn't know each other at all.
No, not at all. Definitely luck.
Right. And for those, for listeners that don't know, 77 was Fishburne Hedges' consumer offer at the time. And it all gets a bit complicated, but Fishburne was owned by Omnicom. And 77 was the, as I say, the consumer shop, which was going pretty well. I can't exactly remember.
Yeah,
about 3 million fee income at various
it was
points.
Good. Yeah, it had grown in the time that we were there.
Fine. What I was going to ask was why did you join 77? But it's presumably because you wanted to get back into consumer PR, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I had my first child at the end of 2004, and after that went back into Chime after my mat leave to set up Team Spirit PR,
right?
Which I loved, and it was a very good experience. But
because you were sort of the founder, so to speak, is that right?
Team Spirit existed as an advertising and integrated agency, and does a very good job. They were looking to develop a PR offer. I went in and started that whole process.
You really were financial services PR.
I was, and actually,
I
think I realised that it was the consumer in consumer finance that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
So actually doing a lot of financial services PR for a couple of years made me realise that's not probably where I thrive. So I wanted to go back to the heartland of doing consumer PR.
Right. I remember this. At the time, you were... Because James Gordon McIntosh and Alan Twigg were there at 77, and I mean... It was about the time we launched PR Moment. I went for it was a beer or a coffee with them, and they were like a sitcom duo. They were proper.
I imagine you went for a beer.
It was too long ago. I can't remember, but you know they were mates basically, weren't they? So it must have been quite hard as an outsider to come into that management team. And I don't want to dig into personalities around that triangle, if you like, but just because it happens to a lot of people in their career when you sort of find yourself okay, and clearly it's worked out. Don't get me wrong, but how did you approach that?
Yeah, I think you know it's always hard, isn't it, being the new kid, and particularly when you're entering. A company where, you know, like you said, Alan and James got on enormously well. They were great fun. I think they were having a lot of fun running that agency. And I think when I first arrived, I mean, I probably did look like the straight guy, you know, in terms of, not quite the fun police, but I definitely was a bit more serious probably. And, you know, they could have been... unwelcoming, but they weren't because I think they realised they needed probably another grown up.
Needed a bit of order.
They did, and they certainly weren't chaotic. Don't get me wrong.
No.
They were doing great work. They'd built a great culture, but I think they needed another person who could be a grown up with them. And I was that person. And I think initially I probably did feel, gosh, you know, I am a bit straight. am I going to be...
Do you start wearing trainers?
I don't know. I haven't got them on today. But, I mean, James would argue that I started copying his style at that point, which is not true. I do not wear a cravat. But I think he thinks I do. So I probably, out of the three of us, was the least funky.
Right. But it worked.
But it worked. It definitely worked.
And it's a distant memory, but didn't you, Alan and James, try and do an MBO of 77 at some point? We did.
I think we'd been running it together for about 3 years. And I think I just had that epiphany of, you know what? You know, we're treating it like this is our agency, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's owned by, you know, many different people and shareholders. And... I don't really know what went through our minds, really, because, you know, it's owned by Omnicom. I mean, Omnicom buy agencies. They don't sell them back to the management team.
I mean, how that might start happening, I don't know. But
well,
certainly. With the benefit of hindsight, they should have taken your offer, shouldn't they? Because
they should have
77 didn't last that much longer. It sort of merged back into
I think it morphed back into...
But certainly, I think it's done all right. You know, consumer offer of Fleischmann's back in the game now and doing really well, but at the time it went down a fair bit, didn't it? And we are, you know, where are we now, Jay?
That would have been 2011.
Okay, so before Ali G rings me up and says what, but that, exactly, that's where we
are. Oh yeah, and I think we were just, I think we were keen to create value for our, not just ourselves, but also for the team.
Right.
And, you know, start to make our own decisions.
Fine. But they said no.
They said no. It was a very short meeting, Ben.
Was it?
Very short meeting.
Fine. And presumably that was pretty... That was a pretty critical moment when you decided, OK, right, we're going to have to leave here and set up our own gig.
We had rather shown our hand by having that initial meeting about doing an MBO. So I think...
Who was that? That wasn't with Neil Hedges. He'd gone by then,
he'd
right?
gone.
Right,
so it was so actually with... Scylla Snowball, who headed up the AMV group in the UK.
It was a
big meeting,
right.
But it was a short meeting.
Yes,
and I think once we'd shown our hands, and actually, once we'd had this sort of, I guess, entertained the notion that maybe we could create our own agency, maybe we don't have to be part of a group. I think it's very hard to then put the genie back into the bottle.
Totally.
It's out there.
Totally.
Which is why...
You've got to give it a go.
Yeah.
It might not work out, but you've got to give it a go.
Absolutely.
And you clearly did give it a go, and it did work out. So how long was the idea in the... in the belly, so to speak? How long was it... were you thinking about it for 20 years? Six months?
No, probably...
A year?
Probably 6 to 9 months.
Okay.
I mean, we
right.
opened our doors on Hope and Glory... At the end of 2011, I think we resigned in the summer, I think probably at the beginning of that year, we had started thinking about what we might do.
Okay, and how did it work? Because in the end, you decided to do it with some equity for Lansons.
That's right.
Did you ever were you ever thinking of going it alone? With a you know, what, it's quite an interesting. I don't want to again go into the details. It was a while back now, but a lot of people when they're starting their agency will think right. Do I get some backing? Do I do it on my own? And there's no right answer. It depends how quickly you want to do things and all of, and how deep your pockets are and all that sort of stuff. But just talk us through that process a bit.
Yeah, I think neither James or I had a lot of kind of cash hanging around.
Right.
You know, maybe a few pennies down the back of the sofa, but nothing that really to write home about.
Wasn't going
to
be enough.
It wasn't. It was definitely not going to be enough. And we had mortgages to pay. And we had, we both had children, and I just think we felt we needed some kind of salary.
Okay.
So actually, finding a backer who could put some capital up that would allow us to, you know, obviously we took a drop in our salaries, but allowed us to take some money home.
Yeah,
was important.
Decrease your risk.
Was important to us.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
So Lansons, in essence, took some shareholding in the business, which you bought back if you hit various numbers over the years.
That's right.
And it's now fairly... Because they're still shareholders, aren't they?
They are.
Albeit
they
minority.
Are. Absolutely.
Fine. And what I always find interesting is... And it absolutely chimes with your personality, is that you didn't have any accounts at launch, did you, for Hope and Glory?
No, we didn't.
You didn't try and do anything dodgy like Nick a client from Omnicom. I can just imagine you saying, no, James, we're not doing that.
No, here again, yet again, I was the straight person in that respect. Do you know what? I think, again, life is too short. And we actually both made the decision that we didn't want to spend the first year as a new agency dealing with letters from lawyers, you know, the emotional grief that comes with knowing you've done something a bit dodgy.
When you can't turn it off. Once it starts, you can't say, sorry, guys, can we all move on? Because it doesn't work like that, does it? I totally agree. And I've seen so many people make that mistake. It can really, really stress things out, can't it?
Yeah, because... and, you know, there is plenty of work out there, actually. Mm.
Yeah, but it's only so. It's an obvious place to go, isn't it? Because you have a relationship with your old clients, clearly. So it's so tempting, but anyway, you decided against it.
Yeah, and you know what? As well, we'd both had relatively, you know, lengthy careers by that point, and so yes, you've got some clients in that moment that you've been working with. But if you've been a good and decent PR throughout your career, you'll have lots of old clients that you can kind of grab a cup of coffee with or talk to. So I think there's definitely something in the adage of don't piss people off on the way up because I look back and I think it was worth being a good account manager, good account director.
Yeah.
And there's lots of people out there to have a relationship with.
Right. The other point is that I guess Omnicom, to be fair, are going to know a bigger, more expensive, better lawyer than you'll be going to be able to afford at that moment of your lives.
That's
so
very true.
You can't compete on that.
Yeah. And I you know what, I really believe in karma as well.
Yeah.
You know, I do think, you know, I don't know, if you're going to act like a complete idiot or be aggressive, you know, you will get caught out.
Mm. But it's tempting because, you know, when you look at your P&L on day one, there's a big fat zero in it. You're like, oh, right. But I was going to say, because those early days must have had some pressure then, right? Because, I mean, I know Ted Young's a very nice, reasonable man. But in the end, you needed to win some business pretty quick, as all new businesses do, yeah?
Yeah, we did. We did. But actually, we pretty much won it straight away. I mean, in terms of, you know, we won, I think DNAD were one of our first clients.
Right.
And I remember pitching for that literally on kind of day one of starting Hope and Glory, to the point where we were, you know, we weren't quite making it up, but certainly we had no backstory. You know, we had our proposal that we'd written, but that whole narrative and the kind of the chat that goes with, well, who are Hope and Glory? And, you know, we were having to make it up on the spot, pretty much. And that was exciting. And we won O2 very early as well.
I mean, how did you win O2? Clearly, I don't mean that from a personal skills perspective. But you know what I mean. It's O2. I don't know whether it was just you and James at the time, but it probably wasn't a lot more. O2 probably knew that, but they still went with you, which is fantastic, isn't it? I mean, how did you pull that one off?
Well, you know, again, it was about having great contacts with people. You know, so we actually, O2 was a, I guess we got it through stealth. So we initially got a project in our first month of opening the doors on Hope and Glory.
Wasn't a Santa one, was it?
It was.
Was that the Santa one?
Yeah, so James had a great idea.
Yeah.
We had an ex-colleague of ours who was actually working at O2. We pitched that idea. It was on the fly. It was like, you might like this. What do you think? And just great timing.
And away you went.
And away we went. And we did that. And then that led to some other projects. And then there was a more formal pitch probably about 6 months after that.
Right.
And you're right, we shouldn't have won it, really.
But by that point, relationships had formed.
It formed, and we'd done good work. And I think you're only as good as your last piece of work. And if the work is really strong, then it puts you in a very good position when it comes to a pitch.
Right. And just talking a little bit about you and James, because you clearly love working together. What is it? And you're one of those partnerships that you quite obviously complement, do you know what I mean? But just talk us through why that is, why you complement each other so well.
Yeah, I do know what, I think a lot of people ask that, and they often say, well, you know, who's Hope and who's Glory? Now, if you've ever met the two
Your
of
hope,
us, I am definitely Hope, and James is definitely Glory.
We didn't line that one up, by the way.
No, but it's true, and I think it works really well because we're very different.
Right.
But we're very different with a healthy respect for what the other one brings.
I don't imagine you've ever had a crossword, have you?
We haven't.
Right.
No, we've been working together now 11 years, 8 years at Hope and Glory. We very rarely, we haven't fallen out.
Right.
Every now and again there might be a raised eyebrow. But
there has to be, isn't it?
Yeah, but I can't even tell you really the last time that happened.
Right.
He's enormous fun to work with. I don't want to. I probably should give him some feedback. Let's not big him up too much because he's good at that himself. Yeah. But he, anyone who's worked with him will know. He's amazingly clever. Annoyingly so. So he has. He's very insightful. He will get to the nub of an issue or a problem or a brief very quickly, but he combines that with also being very creative.
Right. But I'm interested in what it is that the two of you bring, if you see what I mean. So he does that.
Yeah, and what
then,
do I do?
Yeah, well, no, I don't mean that in any way to belittle it, but exactly, because it's the sort of the yin and the yang without being too cliche,
you know what?
Is it?
I think in PR, we're about two things. One is about ideas, the other is about people.
Right.
And I would say he is stronger around the ideas, like where they come from. He's really curious about the work, whereas I'm really curious about people. And that's not to say he's antisocial or he's not. He's quite shy, but he's very good company and he's good fun. But I think he probably takes his energy from the ideas and I take my energy from relationships and with people. And that's what works.
You mean that in its broadest sense, do you? You mean
absolutely.
That for clients, for audiences, for staff, employees? Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think so. And so when we look at how we run the business, It's probably more likely me that would be worrying perhaps about talent or clients, although equally he has great relationships with the team and our clients. And he'd be more worrying about, oh, where's that next campaign going to come from? Oh. What's the next new idea that we can do?
It's quite nice you summarise that, though. Mm-hmm. It's people, and it's, you know, sort of three buckets of people that are important to an agency environment. Okay. Now, for listeners out there thinking of giving it a go in terms of launching an agency, and one of the things I love about PR is that there are it's such an entrepreneurial startup environment. There's always someone else with another idea. What is it? You've done it. It's been spectacularly successful. Possibly, I suspect, more successful than you might have hoped for. What advice do you have for those sorts of people?
Oh, interesting. That's a good question. For me, I mean, I would find a partner in crime.
Okay.
And that's not for everybody, but I think doing it as a duo takes a little bit of the pressure off.
Because you can tag team a little bit.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's very... I mean, I really take my hat off to founders and CEOs who are, you know, literally on their own.
I guess Warren at W being the obvious one, right?
Yeah, because that's a lot to have to do for everything from being, you know, I mean, awful words, cliches, but rainmaker through to being a farmer, you know, looking after your people, looking after the bottom line.
Yep.
There's a lot to do in the job.
Tell me about it.
So actually, I know. So actually, dividing it up, I think that to me would have been definitely a thing.
Presumably, it means you can go quicker, doesn't it?
It does. It does. You've got more bases covered.
Yeah, that's one of my issues. I can't go fast enough because there's only one of me. But you can win a client and then make that go and work on that client, and then James go. You know what I mean? So you're absolutely.
And you divide and conquer, and you play to each other's strengths, and it's quite a powerful combination. If you can find the right partner, I would say consider that. I would also think probably decide what you want to be from the outset in terms of, and by that I mean, do you want to be a lifestyle business or do you want to be a business for growth?
Okay.
Because they're slightly different and they are, I'm not saying one is better than the other, but if you've decided actually you want to start your own business because you want to spend more time with your kids, because you want to perhaps live in a different part of the country, because there are a whole host of reasons that you might want to control your working day and your working life, that's slightly different from saying actually I want to start a business because I want to grow it to 100 people in however many years. And I think you probably need a slightly different plan for both. And I think sometimes what happens is that people don't quite know which of those they want to be.
Do they have to be binary? I'm just trying to work it out.
No, they don't necessarily have to be binary. I think you have to make maybe a few more sacrifices with the latter.
Yeah. Just in terms of time and
time,
effort.
Yeah.
And sorry, I'm not going to be back late again tonight. Basically.
Yeah, there's a little... And I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I mean, I think whenever you start a company and it's your company, of course, you're going to have to make a whole load of compromises and you work very hard. But I think if it's about, actually, I want to do this because I want to spend more time with my kids, you might think, well, actually, then to do that, you know, if I push too hard on the growth button, I'm actually going to spend less time with my kids than more.
But you've managed that. I mean, I don't imagine for a moment that you, as a parent, have not seen lots of your kids over the last 8 years. So you might have seen more of them, but you know what I mean? It's not something... I don't know this, but knowing you as a person, I don't imagine you'd have... You know, you're not a... You've been there with your kid at the important moments.
Yeah, you're right, I have. I've always prioritised, if there's a school assembly I need to be at. Or...
So I just... We don't want to suggest it's a... if you're going to grow a business, it's you never see your family.
No, of course not. But I think there are plenty of people who run brilliant agencies that might be 10 or 15 people and will stay at that level for a long time. And that's fine because actually that's throwing off a great income.
Yep.
They're having a lot of fun. They're doing a lot of work, good work with clients that they like. That's slightly different. But actually, and sometimes those... agency, because that's what I want to do. But I think we probably went into it thinking we'd quite like to see how far we can take this.
Is that right? So at launch you thought, right, we want to, I don't know, we thought about it in people terms or revenue terms, but you wanted to launch a big agency. And you know, I don't want to, this is a, what did we say, £8.5 million agency, wasn't it? So it's not, I don't want to give the impression it's it's huge, but it's, you know, it's going quite well after whatever it is, 9 years or so. So
yeah, I think we probably went into it wanting to escalate and grow quite quickly.
Right.
I don't quite know why that was.
No.
Looking back, I mean, we should have just put our feet up. I don't know what we were doing, but yeah.
Fine. Anything else on the lessons for entrepreneurs?
I would two other things probably. One is focus on the work.
Okay.
Because I've said this before, but I really believe you're only as good as your last campaign, and actually the work needs to do the talking for you. So I think
that's tough, though, isn't it? I mean, I get that point, and I agree with it, but it's
hard.
You can't really.
You can't be complacent.
Every campaign can't be better than the last campaign, can it? Not forever.
I think you should just strive for it.
Definitely strive for it.
Yeah. No, of course. Yeah. I mean, real life will probably get in the way.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing I would say is say no as much as you say yes, because I think. But having a clear idea of what kind of clients you want to work with, what kind of people you want to work with, what your culture is. And actually, it's quite empowering to say no to a few things quite early on, because that will define who you are. And that's hard, because if you're trying to pay a mortgage...
Totally.
And actually you think, well, any income is good income, it can quite quickly define you.
And you get sidetracked.
You can, and you can end up working with... it might be fortuitous. You might end up in an area that you didn't think you wanted to be in, but... Actually, you can easily get sidetracked, and before you know it, you're 2 or 3 years in, and actually, it's not quite the client portfolio you wanted.
And by that point, you've lost momentum and all that type of stuff. Okay. Now, in simple terms, seems to me anyway that the key to growing an agency business is to win lots of new business. Obviously enough, but you also need to hang on to the business you've got. And I think one of the things that it seems to me, as a sort of observer, is that Hope and Glory have hung on to some pretty chunky accounts. The most prominent one, I guess, is O2, that is still an account that you, as you described earlier, you launched with. IKEA, so O2 have been an account for Hope and Glory for, 8 years, if my maths is about
That's
there.
That's right, yeah.
IKEA, 6 years, something
seven
like
years,
that.
Yeah.
7 years. So, you know, these are long-term chunky accounts. How have you managed to hold on to them for so long, would you say?
I think a number of reasons. I think the work, again, sorry to raise that word again.
That's a fair point, isn't it?
But actually...
I mean, that might be the only thing, actually. Yeah.
Well,
maybe, I don't know.
I think it's more than the work. I think it's also the relationship. People like working with people they like. And we try and make that relationship as easy as possible. So I think, we're very blessed. We have a very talented team who are genuinely nice people.
Oh.
And as a result, we attract very nice clients who are genuinely nice people. So I think being able to work collaboratively with our clients where people like each other and as a result do good work is really important.
Yeah, OK. Fine, as simple as that.
Well, I sound like I've really simplified it, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that...
hire nice people and work with nice people.
Yeah, and it's not rocket science, right?
Okay.
Do what you're going to say you're going to do.
Right.
I always think that relationships fall apart in the way that actually romantic relationships fall apart. You start to take each other for granted, you get complacent... somebody leaves the toilet seat up, somebody's forgotten their birth, it's all the little niggles that start to become an issue.
Right.
And I think you've got to just be hot on that.
How do you keep, because that's easier said, but actually when life's busy and what an agency environment's like, it's quite hard to do, isn't it?
It is.
I bet that's what you do, isn't it? I bet that's what you're good at. You just look after all the details.
Yeah, to a degree.
Yeah.
Well, I think the team do it. And
okay.
I think...
But you create the culture, is what I mean.
Yeah, I hope
not
so.
From, yeah.
Yeah, I think let's never take anything for granted.
Yeah.
Let's not be complacent. Let's make sure that we're really, coming up with the right idea at the right time.
Have you got... I was just thinking about O2... I don't know about IKEA, but the personalities at O2 on that leadership side are the same as when you launched, aren't they? There's a bit of luck there, isn't there? Because if that had changed, that's always... I'm not saying you would have lost it, but there's a greater element of risk there, I would suggest.
Yeah, that's true. But I think actually we've got a number of clients where the leadership has changed.
Okay.
But the strength of the relationship, the strength of the work has meant that they haven't decided, oh, actually, I'm new, right. So we need to change everything.
Okay. I think that's a big lesson then for other agencies, because you see that all the time, don't you? Oh, we're doing really well, and then so-and-so left. And I mean, you can't always get it right, but if you can, you know, if you can only lose... If you can lose less of those types of things, then it's
yeah. You don't want to be a leaky bucket, right?
No,
and I
no.
think there, you know, there are lots of agencies potentially that, you know, welcome a client in, and if they don't get that client service bit right, you know, the client comes in the front door, and then they're out the back door pretty quickly. And luckily for us, that hasn't happened.
Fine. Now, PR firms, and particularly consumer PR firms, have. You know, I was going to say, yeah, always struggled, frankly, to get a 20% margin, I would say. I know, often struggled, let's put it that way. And I know it's something you've worked pretty hard on in recent years, increasing your margin. Have you managed to do that? What's, I guess, retaining the quality of the work?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's a conundrum for every agency around that margin figure. You know, 20% is a number that's kind of bandied around. How do you get to 20%? I mean, we certainly don't do it by working our people to the bone, because that's not going to be productive or helpful.
No, you're in a creative industry.
We are, and you need, you know, I think you need to do it in a way that you maintain a great culture, that people are still out the door by 6:30 in the evening. That, you know, you don't want to create a kind of sweatshop environment. So how have we done it? I think just by being a bit quicker and a bit more effective and efficient. So we've probably looked a little bit more at, you know, where are we spending our time? Are we being as, I don't know, as productive as we could be? Are we being fast enough?
Just lots of tiny little things.
Do you know what? It's a little bit like looking at reducing that kind of margin.
Yeah, marginal gains.
That's the phrase we're looking for, marginal gains.
Right.
In fact, a couple of years ago, we had a whole away day about marginal gains.
Did you?
And it was very funny because we did it. I probably shouldn't share the story. And we all felt quite kind of fired up about the little things that we could do just to make ourselves, you know, better. And then the following week, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. Our IT system, we had a flood in the office, we had the fire engines came out, there was a fire in the building. And it actually, hashtag marginal gains became a bit of a meme within Hope of Glory that week. And I thought, God, we can't even get the big things right, let alone the marginal gains.
Well, sometimes you have things like that, you have weeks like that in businesses, don't you? Now, you and James aren't the only shareholders in the business. You've recently appointed two joint MDs.
That's right.
Just talk us through the other important personalities in Hope and Glory, because I get a sense that's been important in the scaling of it, because clearly you couldn't have done it on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we are, as I said earlier, we're really blessed with a very talented and actually very loyal team.
The senior staff
have been with us a long time. Yeah. And actually, you know, I think average retention is 3 or 4 years. But a lot of people have been, I think about 25% of the agency have been with us more than 5 years.
Right.
So in terms of the senior team, we've got Adrian Chitty, who joined us probably about 2 or 3 months in. He would have been the third person in. Actually, as it happened, he was the fifth or sixth person in because we'd won a couple of clients before he joined, and we needed a few people to help.
He's creative.
He's one of the partners. The other partner who joined us fairly early on is Gavin.
Yep.
Gavin Lewis, who's our creative director,
who's
brilliant. So the two of them were great partners to begin with. And then we've actually expanded our board. So we're now a board of 10, of which there's Anna. And there's also Seb, who've recently become our joint MDs, and they've been with us for a while.
Okay.
In addition to that, we've got Don, we've got Charlie, we've got Valerie, we've got Laura, all of whom have been with the agency for quite some time and have worked their way up onto the board. So we really believe in kind of homegrown talent.
I was going to say, what you're not doing is hiring externally at a senior level. You tend to promote from within.
We would definitely prefer that. Yeah. Partly because we all know each other. You know what you're getting.
You see it all the time. I often think that senior appointment is such a risk. I mean, it can work out, don't get me wrong, but Especially for a ship that's going as well as yours at the moment, it's a risk that's possibly not worth taking.
Well, as you said earlier, you know, when I joined 77, I was the new person coming in, at a very senior level, and it is quite intimidating.
Yeah.
And
but it worked.
It did work. It did work. That was lucky. So we've got a great board, and then actually the next layer down are really strong as well. So we've got a lot of very good associate directors who've grown up with us.
Right, and I get the feeling that's the sort of next phase of the strategy, is to try and take it or take the reliance any away, and that may be a perception away from you and James and to other areas, other people within the team.
Yeah, I think, we're now an agency of 80 people.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, we need a few more people pulling on the rope.
Yeah.
James and I can't be making all the decisions, and nor should we be.
Yeah.
And equally, James and I started Hope and Glory because we wanted to go back to doing the work, working with clients.
Right.
And if you're not careful, you can spend your whole time in the business of running an agency.
Yeah.
And then you get further away from the clients and the work.
In that sort of role, the more questions you answer, the more questions you're going to get.
Absolutely. So I think part of the reason why Seb and Anna have stepped into their role is that we could share some of that load of running an agency so that James can spend more time noodling about with creative ideas, and I can spend a bit more time thinking about client relationships, thinking about how we enhance that, how we enhance our offer, thinking about the talent in the business, how do we make sure that they stick around.
Fine, I like that idea. James noodling about.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Now, finally, in our pre-show chat, we were talking about the number of prominent and really good women who have left their senior jobs in agencies in the last 6 months. And then just as we were talking about that, I think we both had the thought about the same time. We realised that most of those, not all, but most of those really prominent women had left sort of group-owned PR firms. And actually, if you had a conversation around really successful and prominent women in independent agencies, they're all still there and still doing really well, frankly. So just created a bit of hypothesis, didn't it, as we were having a chat. Do you think there might be something there, that independent agencies are currently anyway more fun, more flexible and perhaps a bit easier to lead than their group-owned peers?
Do you know what, I think there's definitely something in the fact that if you're independent, you're kind of calling the shots a bit more. I mean, you can set the culture and you can... you can determine how you want your destiny to go, really. And I think if you're part of a group, that's much harder. And I'm not saying, I think, lots of the groups are very forward-thinking.
Definitely.
And actually the women who were, at the helm of those groups, I'm sure, felt they were kind of developing good and positive cultures. But a lot of them are owned by maybe come out of the States. There are other cultural forces at work, I think, which would perhaps make it more difficult.
Right. I suppose growth also helps, doesn't it? If you're running a firm that's growing at whatever you are, 25%, it's a bit easier to manage than one that's either growing at 1 or 2 or 3%.
Yeah, I think it certainly takes the pressure off a bit. And also your margin and all your, we can choose to put it under the spotlight or not, whereas actually there's nowhere to hide if you're in a group.
Sure.
You've got everybody poring over your numbers the whole time. And I think that must be challenging.
Without a doubt, yeah, no doubt. And well, if you're not growing at a quick enough rate, and you've got to give everyone a pay rise, and the rent's going up, and all the various tools you need to purchase are costing more, and we'll be talking about it later on, aren't we? About the idea that you used to have the sort of unbundling of the PR executive. So whereas you used to have one job, there's now six different specialists required. So, it's a game that's changing relatively quickly. And I suspect it's not becoming cheaper to run a PR firm, is it? And I suppose the trick is whether client fees are going up at the same rate.
Absolutely. And I think, these group jobs, they're high pressure.
Right.
They're big jobs. And I think I would find it challenging. There's a reason why I'm not doing it.
Right.
I like running an independent. I like being the person who, the buck stops with me.
Fine.
And James, obviously. the two of us.
You added that bit on there.
Yeah.
You gave it all away there, Joe. Brilliant. Joe Carr, thank you so much for coming on the PRM podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the PR Moment podcast, produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
If you'd enjoyed the show, please do review us on iTunes and give us a decent rating.